All right, so this week's parsha, last year, we talked about the sota and some of our presumptions about the sota, assumptions about how sota plays out, and then re-examine them in light of the text itself. I'd like to do something of a similar exercise with this week's haftarah.
What's Tashlumei
Aseret? Oh, very good. I'm glad you asked. You know, it's great. Nobody ever looks at my headers. And I would put really cute things in there. What? I actually had somebody come up to me in Toronto over Yontif and say, what's this Shnat Samach Tev Lechem? What is it? So I got a chance to tell them. Tashlumei Aseret. Okay, very good. There is a prevalent minhag in Kehilot of Hasidim, in Kehilot of Idot HaMizrach, not to say Tachanun until after the 12th of Sivan. The prevalent minhag in German communities is to say Tachanun beginning on the 9th, meaning you don't say Tachanun on the 8th, which was yesterday because it's Yitzhu Chag, but today they say Tachanun, which is why everybody flocks to Chassidus Shulz for the next few days, especially tomorrow morning. The thinking behind the Ashkenazi minhag is actually straightforward, which is you have a chag, there's a notion of Yisru Chag, which is an interesting little play off of a pasuk that means nothing to do with the day after in Tehillim, Yisru Chag Bavotim, but that has nothing to do, it has to do with tying an animal up. But the notion of Yisru Chag, that the day afterwards still maintains some of the joyous feeling, so we don't say Tachnun. However, Shavuot is unique because we have the three regalim, which are all parallel to each other, and yet Shavuot is only one day as opposed to 7 days. And so even though we're the festival of Shavuot, the Mikra Kodesh of Shavuot is only one day, from another perspective, it's a full week. From a perspective of bringing Korban Chagigah, the Korban that we're obligated to bring 3 times a year, the Korbanot that we're supposed to bring 3 times a year, as part of Aliyah L'Regel, the Olat Riyah and Shomei Chagigah and Shomei Simcha, which ideally we would bring at the beginning of a Chag, we have all 7 days. And the days after the first are known as Tashlumin. And the question is, are they Tashlumin Derishon? It's Machloket Rabbi Yochanan Rosh Lakish. Tashlumin Derishon or Tashlumin Zelazeh? Meaning, are they all Ki'ilu makeup for the first day that you should have brought it? Or is it that the first day you should have brought it, but you didn't, you bring it on the second day? If you didn't bring it on the second day, are you now making up for the second day? For the first day, it has an interesting implication as to how to decide on that. So these days are called Tashlum, they're called by me, I guess, Tashlumei Aseret. These are the days of completing the Korban or of making up for the Korban of Shavuot that we didn't bring. And so just in a fit of whimsy, I put that down as a title. But thanks for noticing that. Okay. Oh, yeah, L'chidush Malchut Yisrael. Or L'chidush Medinat Yisrael. We're in the 69th year of statehood. And I put that on really as a consciousness raiser more. We should realize we live in miraculous times and we need to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu every day really for that. I probably told this story many, many years ago, but as everybody around this table knows, I'm not shy. And when I was in Keren B'Yavneh, I had a rabbi, and some of you know Keren B'Yavneh, know that the faculty at Keren B'Yavneh runs the gamut, or has run the gamut in the past, the people who are more oriented towards a religious Zionist outlook, and perhaps a little bit less. And I had a Rebbe who, from all external perspectives and even seemingly Hashkafic perspectives, seemed to be a little less. And I was very friendly with him. It turns out he was friendly with my family back in Yerushalayim in the old days, and I babysat his kids. So it was after being there a couple of years. I was davening next to him on Yom Ha'atzmaut, and he was saying Hallel. He had his eyes closed, and he was shaking. He was really into it. So I went up to him afterwards, and in a very typical bit of chutzpah, I said, Reb David, were you saying Hallel like that because you really feel thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us a Medina, or because you work at a B'nai Akiva Yeshiva, and I can't, you know, kind of go with the flow? So he looked at me, and he said, Reb Yitzchak, as far as I'm concerned, we should say Hallel every day. He said, I remember what it was like before Medina. I remember what it was like when we didn't have a state. And I said to him, you know, I know people who live in the States who are in yeshiva. They don't even know today's a special day. They don't know AER exists. So he said to me something, I'll never forget this. This is now close to 40 years ago. He said, you tell them that the reason they're able to walk around the streets of New York with their tzitzis out is because we have a Medina. Something people don't think about. The extent to which Jewish pride and Jewish awareness and nationalism has been elevated first in 48 and then exponentially in 67 is really something not to forget. So as a consciousness raiser, you know, we have to remember that we live in miraculous times. Plus, I haven't met too many people lately who really are committed to the idea that the world is less than 6,000 years old. So, you know, using that date doesn't carry a lot of religious meaning. It's really just a convention. But in any case, so this week's Haftarah is a very bizarre piece. It's a bizarre piece because as a Haftarah, it's kind of reasonable. We don't really have any stories in Nevi'im about Sotas. And so Sota and Nazir are sort of the two prime halachic passages in the Parsha, and we do have a very famous story of a Nazir, and that is the story of Shimshon. However, if you're looking at Shimshon and you want to pick something out of the Nevi'im, and again, why do we have Haftarot? The consensus is that at some point, likely in Greek times, there was a decree made where we were not allowed to read the Torah publicly. And so what the custom that arose was to read a passage from the Nevi'im that either approximated thematically or linguistically the missed Torah reading. And even though that decree was long ago repealed or ignored or just kind of went away, we continue to have the Haftarah. And the Haftarah is always from the Nevi'im. And following the Babylonian custom, which is the universal custom, the Haftarah follows thematically a central theme in the Parsha. So in Parshat Bereishit, the Haftarah is from Yeshayahu, a passage that describes creation in beautiful terms. The Haftarah Bahalotcha, which starts with the mitzvah of the menorah, is the passage we read from Zechariah about the menorah in Beit Sheni, etc. And so you look at Parshat Naso, and Parshat Naso is huge. Everybody knows it's the longest Parsha, although by far not the hardest one to lay, but the longest Parsha, 176 Psukim. And yet, there is not a whole lot in it to grab onto that would make for a ready parallel story in the Nevi'im, except for Nazir. But the reality is, there's only one famous Nazir who's explicitly a Nazir in Tanakh, even though Chazal suggests that Avshalom was a Nazir and that Shmuel was a Nazir. Unclear about that. However, Shimshon being a Nazir is not only clear, but it is the source of his entire story. His strength comes from his Nazirut, and his downfall comes as a result of kind of giving that away. So it kind of stands to reason that we would look to Shimshon for our Haftarah. But the problem is that you look at the story of Shimshon, and there's really no place you could plug into, with save one, where the theme of the Nazirut is prime. Because most of his stories are kind of difficult for us to read publicly anyways, because they have to do with illicit relations and problematic interactions and a lot of revenge. And the place where the Nazirut becomes most prominent is a story that we really wouldn't want our kids to hear, which is Shimshon v'Udlila, which when he finally opens up, and he says, Nazir Elohim ani mim beten, right? And if you shave my hair, I'll lose my strength. And he finally gives in to her, and she gets him to sleep, and she shaves his head, and that's the end of it. So it's not really a story that we're going to read. So we end up reading the introduction to the story of Shimshon, which is what I call a prelude to Shimshon. But you look at this parak, and forgetting about the issue of Haftarah, just reading this within Sefer Shoftim, it's very weird. Because first of all, this entire parak is an annunciation. It's the prophetic telling of the birth of a savior. Well, where do we have that before in Tanakh? You're right, we don't. It doesn't exist. Where do we have the prophetic telling of the birth of an anybody? So Yitzchak, how much room does that take? Two psukim, three psukim, and then a big visit. Okay, a big visit, about 10 psukim or so. A whole parak? That's first of all. Who else is foretold?
It always reminds me of Shmuel. I don't know. Because
good. Similar. So why does it remind you of Shmuel?
Because
the mother is the prime character.
Right.
There's a prophetic slash prayerful prelude to the prelude, to the birth, right? The names even sound alike. Shmuel Shimshon. And the son has some sort of a dedication motif. And you're right. And the Chazal actually pick up on that and say that Shmuel is a Nazir. However, and because of the same word morah that's used here, it's used there, But the problem is that when you draw Shmuel and Shimshon next to each other, you see how vastly different they are. Is that, first of all, what's Shmuel's job? He's a Navi. Shimshon does everything but. What's Shmuel's position in history? He's the one who initiates monarchy and a unity of the people. Shimshon does everything but. Shmuel is a Levi. Shimshon is from Dan. Shmuel is fully, wholly dedicated to Am Yisrael. Almost all of Shimshon's interactions, including romantic or marital ones, are with Plishtim. You couldn't find two more different characters. I mean, you could. The other one could be a woman or something. But there's nothing alike about them, and yet you're right. We feel instinctively some sort of a connection. But when you look at the issue of an annunciation, of a prophetic telling about somebody coming, so you have Yitzchak, who's very famous. Who else do you have? So you have in Yeshayahu a small passage, which of course became very, very big, but not in our circles, which is in Yeshayahu Zion, right, when the Hinei Hara, Alma Hara, Violadet Bein, the Karat Shmo Immanuel, etc., etc., right, which is of course about either Chizkiyahu or Yeshayahu having a baby, not about any guy 700 years later, you know, and etc. But it's a very bizarre thing. And so this parak really stands in absolute isolation relative to the rest of Tanakh. It's just really different. So I figured what we might want to do is just study the parak together, study the Haftarah together, read it through, see what it says. I really want to thank, publicly, I want to thank Elliot because, I mean, he's a sweetheart. And I had put this together last night, and I put it together, and I Xeroxed it this morning at school. And then midday, I came home after grading the last final, and I said, you know what, and I realized there was a color scheme that I had to put into here. And at the last minute, I just sent it to Elliot. I said, if you don't mind, please. And I came here, and they were on my desk. He's a real tzaddik. So thank you, Elliot. Okay. Remember that the entire scope of Sefer Shoftim is, well, should we say the structure of Sefer Shoftim is made up of three pieces. The first piece, which is 2.5 prakim, is an introduction. It can sets the stage for Shoftim. And the stage for Shoftim is that everybody is living tribally. Many tribes, all but one really, or one or two, have not conquered pieces of their territory they're supposed to conquer. And so there are nations living among them who are pagans, with whom the Bnei Yisrael are interacting, are having business relations, end up having intermarriages, etc., which, of course, is exactly what we were warned about in Dvarim, and Sefer Yoshua, for one reason or another, kind of didn't go there. The end of Sefer Shoftim are two major events that do not take place at the end of Sefer Shoftim. There are events that at least one of them takes place chronologically way at the beginning, because the only person that has a name in that whole story is Pinchas, who is the Kohen Gadol at the beginning of the period. But they're placed at the end for strategic reason. The two stories are known as Pesel Micha and Pilagish Begiva. Pilagish Begiva is the most horrific story in Tanakh. Just by way of example, years ago when I was third year I was teaching at the girls' school, I had a group of 12th grade girls, amazing, amazing class. And we were studying Yoshua Shoftim together. And usually, one parak would take two classes. I did the three Prakim of Pilagish Begiva in 45 minutes. Because I just did not want them to have nightmares. That's how gory a story it is. And these stories, just everybody's bad. They're almost competing for who can be worse. And the middle part of... And the reason they're at the end is to set the stage for the anthem of Sefer Shoftim, which is, Bayamim Ahem, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, Ish HaYashar Ben Nechol HaYashar Ben Av Yaseh. There is no king, and everybody's doing exactly what's right in their own eyes. There's chaos, there is Hefkerut. And that sets the stage for what Sefer Shmuel is about, which is finding a king. The middle of Sefer Shoftim is what we call Alilot HaShoftim, the stories of the Shoftim. And parenthetically, if you ask for a translation of Shoftim, everybody on the street will say judges. Alex Trebek will say judges, or his judges will, his Shoftim will. But if you read Sefer Shoftim, you'll realize no individual in that book does any judging. The best translation for Shoftim would likely be chieftains. Except the Irish already took that with a great band, so we'd probably call it guerrilla warriors or something. Because every one of them, and the best proof is in Perek Bet, where it says, Vayakim Adonai Shoftim Vayoshium. God raises up Shoftim who save them from their oppressors. The cycle that happens is Bnei Yisrael, or particular tribes, do Avodah Zarah. God immediately puts them under the thumb of some foreign oppressor. They're under the foreign oppressor for anywhere from 8 to 18 years. At some point, they finally cry out with enough pain, and not necessarily daven, just cry out in enough pain, and God then raises a shofet, who's one of the members of that tribe, who leads a rebellion. They overthrow the oppressor, and they live happily ever after, usually until that guy dies, and they go back to Avodah Zarah. It's really a tragic book, which, again, underscores the need for a unified leadership and unified government and centralized nation. The middle section is these Alot HaShoftim, which begin with the very short piece about Otniel, who is from Shevet Yehuda. And remember, in the Midbar, in the desert, as we read about last week's Parsha, Yehuda leads the first camp. And it goes through, and the very last of the Shoftim, who may not have been last in order, but is last in the book, is Shimshon, who is from Shevet Dan, which, if you remember, is the last camp. Interesting is that Shevet Dan, both in Chumash and in this story, have, if there's one animal that you're to associate with this story, what would the animal be?
A lion.
And if you think about Shevet Dan in Zot HaBracha, Dan Gur Aryeh, which is interesting because Aryeh, of course, is the sign of which Shevet?
Yehuda.
Right? So, it is an interesting intersection that Israel Rosenson wrote about the connection between Dan and Yehuda throughout. At the first chapter of Shoftim describes how Yehuda conquered all their territory, and at the very last pasuk is how Dan conquered none of its territory. So it's from the beginning to the end. But what we have is these stories of the Shoftim, and the last of the Shoftim is Shimshon. Shimshon gets more press than anybody. He gets four chapters. And although a couple of chapters are short, but what's even more remarkable is he gets a whole chapter in which he only shows up at the end when he gets born, which again is absolutely unique. So what I want to do is look at the Perek, see if we can figure out what's going on in the Perek, and keep in mind the whole time, why is this Perek even here in Tanakh? And what's the significance? Because again, it occupies a lot of space for something we're not used to. Yeah, Jason, would you want to ask? All right, let's take a look at the Perek. Now, the Perek is introduced as follows. Important to note, the previous Perek ended with what we call the Shoftim HaChronologim or Shoftim HaKtanim. There's little three pasuk vignettes about, not even a vignette, just on a kind of chronological record. Afterwards was Tolab ben Puah from Yisachar, and he judged for 6 years, and he died here, he was buried there. Next, boom, boom, boom. Now we get to this. Now, many of the major Shoftim, Anu Dvorah, actually Otniel, Ehud, Dvorah Barak, Gidon, and Yiftach are all introduced with one or two psukim that give us, and in the case of Gidon, more than that, they give us the background of the terror that's going on, who's oppressing us. Here we have just one pasuk. Vayasifu bnei Yisrael asot hara bnei Adonai. Again, they continue to do evil. And by the way, on the back, it's all in English. Vayitnei Adonai b'ad plishtim arbeim shana. So now they're oppressed for 40 years. 40 years. All right? Vayhi. Now, this is out of nowhere. Ish achad mitzoram imishpachat adani ushmo manoach. Now, this guy lives in Tzorah. Tzorah, by the way, today is, on top of the hill in Tzorah, you can see there's a strategic place where the Palmach launched several attacks in defense of Yerushalayim or to try to reconquer Yerushalayim. And there's a maskeret up there. You can see like a viewpoint. Mishpachat Adani Ushmo Manoach. So there's a guy named Manoach. V'ishto akara v'lo yalada. And when you're reading Shoftim, you got to wonder, who cares? I'm like, what is this doing here? So when do we hear about barren women?
In
Bereishit, it is because they are the wives of our central character. Here's Avraham, his wife's barren. Here's Yitzchak, his wife's barren. Here's Yaakov, boom, 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 Rachel. Yep. So it's always around the central family. Here, we never heard of this guy. I don't know where you hear. There's a guy named Manoach. And by the way, his wife is an Akara. Now, important to keep in mind also, how many Akarot do we know of in Tanakh? So we typically think of seven, right? Which is Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. If you take a look carefully, Leah is also an Akara. Seems to be. This woman, Chana and the Shunammite, the one who's got no name, that Elisha blesses.
Right.
Those are the ones I've had interesting discussions about whether root was an akara, not an akara. But in any case, this is like out of nowhere. This is a guy named Manoach. We never heard of him before. And by the way, his wife is an akara v'lo yalada. Why do we need to know that? So let's keep going. Now you'll notice, and I made it green, that there are seven instances of the word ro'eh, the verb ro'eh, in this parak, in the context of this malach showing up. Right? You'll see, and there's two others, but I put them in a different color because they're not about the malach showing up. Behold, you are an akara, which may mean, by the way, she didn't even know it. Maybe they were newlyweds. And maybe she didn't know she was an akara. Vaharit v'yaladet ben. Right? But you're going to become pregnant and have a kid. Out of nowhere, malach comes and says. Now, this appearance of a malach out of nowhere to kind of spur on salvation is not new. It happened with Gidon. Gidon was working in the field. He was actually threshing wheat in a wine press. It's a whole parsha by itself in Shoftim Vav. And a malach shows up and says, Anoim cha gibor achayo, lech b'chocha zed, you're going to go save Sheva ben Asher from the oppressors, etc. You're going to save Am Yisrael. So he comes, but he doesn't come and say, you're going to say, he comes and says, by the way, you're barren, you're pregnant, you're going to have a kid. V'ata, then what does he tell her? He shamrina v'al tishti yain v'shechar. Be very careful and don't drink any alcoholic drinks. V'al tochli kol tameh. Now, kol tameh may mean something that's not appropriate to eat, which may mean that they were eating things that weren't appropriate to eat. Said, you got to keep a special kosher diet. Unclear if it means that, or it means maybe something even on a higher level. Why? Ki hinach harav yoladet ben, which, by the way, he already said to her. Right? Umora lo yale al rosho. That doesn't mean the teacher won't hit him in the head. It means a razor will not go on his head. Which means, what's it going to be? Yeah, but kind of, sort of, maybe. Watch this. Ki nazir Elohim yanar min abaten. He's going to be a nazir from the get-go, from the stomach, from the belly, from the womb. And what else is he going to do? He's going to begin the salvation against the Plishtim. Right? Now, by the way, this is a little bit of a, what we might call a chatzi nechama. This is kind of good news, but not great news because he's only going to start. Right? Second piece of the puzzle is how is he going to save Yisrael miyad Plishtim? Without knowing the story, if you hear that, what do you think he's going to do? He's probably going to kill Plishtim. Wait a second, what's one of the rules of a Nazir? Tumat mate. So, second of all, let's say that there were parents who decided, if we have a boy, he's a Nazir. And by the way, if we have a girl, she's a Nazira. And let's just say that does work. Is the mother bound to avoid alcohol? It might be a good idea if you're pregnant in general. But is she bound to avoid alcohol because her kid's going to be a Nazir? Not at all. So this whole thing is weird. There's something else that happens. That's why I put this in red, and you'll see the parallel, as it were, in blue. So the woman shows up and comes to her husband. And by the way, generally, who do malachim show up to? So who's the first malach appeared to? You can participate in Mordechai. Okay. Avram, then? Right, Yaakov, famously? Right, several times too, Yaakov. Okay, then Moshe, that whole scene in the lodge. Right, then Yoshua. Right, it's Yericho with the sword. Okay, then Gidon. Notice all these are men. Okay, Mrs. Manoach alone has this vision, and so she then runs to her husband and says, "Ish Elohim ba Eli." What does she call him? An Ish Elohim. Which means, what does she think he is? What's an Ish Elohim in Tanakh? A Navi. She thinks it's a guy. A guy who's some sort of prophetic guy walking around telling people, oh, you're going to have a baby, right? Like this. Umareu kamarei malach Elohim. How does she describe him? He looks angelic. Nora miod, quite terrifying. Velo shiltiu emizehu vetchmo lo yigidli. I didn't ask him anything about where he's from, what his name is. Some mysterious guy who looks angelic showed up. And then she says, Vayomer li hinach harav yoladet ben. That's the good news. Ve'ata al tishti yain v'shechar ve'al tuchli kol tumah. And then he also told me what to avoid eating and drinking. Kinezir Elohim Yanar min habeten, watch this, ad yom moto. What else would she left out? Right, she doesn't say anything about him as a warrior. In other words, as far as what she told her husband, are we going to have a baby, and this baby is sanctified to God. And how are we going to have him sanctified to God? I'm supposed to avoid eating and drinking this stuff. Nothing about his diet, mm-hmm. Although you might say that's assumed.
Yeah, Nazir. She said
Yom Moto. What else? Yeah, but and what else is left out?
No, but you could have said.
Well,
you could have said that he was a Nazir until the point of birth because she stopped drinking.
No, but that's not what the guy said. That's,
he says he's a Nazir.
No, he said the kid's going to be a Nazir. If the kid's going to be a Nazir, that means he's a Nazir. And since nobody took this oath, there's no way you can be Shoel on it, and therefore it's forever. That I get. But notice, what did she leave out? She left out anything on haircutting. The only message was what she has to avoid, and that he is a Nazir Elohim in Abetan, which we really don't know what that means. Is that some sort of weird category of Nazir? Which is why the Mishnah in the first parak of Nazir talks about Nazir Shimshon. Is Nazir Shimshon a unique category? Or according to Shimon, it doesn't exist. There is no such thing as Nazir Shimshon. Shimshon wasn't a Nazir. It's not really unclear what's going on. I'll tell you further than this. And she leaves anything out about him being a warrior, but she adds in something else, Benabeta Nadyom Moto. Which, from the long view, after you read the whole story, you might want to look back and say, aha, because what did the Malach say? Hu yachel lohoshia. He's going to begin. And by the way, when does he really begin saving Am Yisrael from the police team? When he brings the house down. Right? When he dies, and he brings the house down and kills 3,000 police team on himself. So it could be that the text is kind of weaving the two together. But notice what she left out. There's something surprising here. Now,
then Nazir have to stay a Nazir until he's dead.
Unless he makes Nazir. If he just says I'm a Nazir, I'm not saying it. Says I'm a Nazir, it's 30 days.
He was told that you have to be a Nazir, but doesn't say until he's dead.
Correct. But if a person takes a regular... This is all weird. This is all not standard. If a person says I'm a Nazir, then that's 30 days. If I'm a Nazir twice, it's 30 days and 30 days. And by the way, he has to do the whole ceremony after 30 and again after 60. Right? If he says I'm a Nazir for a year, that works. If he says I'm a Nazir my whole life, that also works. But here, nobody said I'm a Nazir, which means really it shouldn't work at all. But if it's going to work, there's no time frame in it. It must be forever. At least that's how she interpreted it. But of course, if the Malach said to her, he's going to be a Nazir and he's going to start fighting against the police team, well, he's got to grow up a little bit, which would mean that maybe that's how she understood the Malach, saying he's going to be a Nazir forever because it's not 30 days, it's not a year. He's got to be born and grow up and be big enough to beat up police team. But on the other hand, he's going to go to war. And by the way, who is it who is actually banned from drinking here? She is. What's really weird, and I haven't seen anybody, I'm sure people have noticed, I haven't seen anybody who mentioned this, is what becomes the big deal with Shimshon as far as his Nazirut goes? Remember, a Nazir is bound by three things. Haircutting, drinking, and Tumat Mate. Tumat Mate is clearly off the table. It's just not an issue here. He kills police team left and right. Nobody seems to have a problem with that. Okay? What's the thing? What? Animal's not a Tumat Mate. That's Tumat Nevela. That's not a problem. Right? But what's the one thing that gets him in real trouble?
The hair.
Yeah. Okay, good. So we'll say Shimshon's not allowed to cut his hair. Parenthetically, that's not something she didn't mention to her husband. But we know he's not allowed to cut his hair. What about drinking? So, I don't know. My whole life, I've walked around assuming that Shimshon avoided wine. And the biggest reason I think that he's avoiding wine is because of the famous story, which is the next parak, which we looked at when we talked about Yosef's dreams, because of Shimshon's riddle. Is that Shimshon, they went to Timnah, and he went around the Kerem, and that's where he met the lion, ripped the lion up, et cetera, right? And the assumption is he walked around the Kerem because no smart Nazir is going to walk through a Kerem, he might blow it. Yeah. On the other hand, think about this. What does Shimshon do when he gets to Timnah that second time for his marriage? Vayas Mishteh. What's a Mishteh?
Wine.
A Mishteh is a banquet party with wine. It doesn't say that he avoids it. Furthermore, later on in the story, when his final downfall happens, how does the final downfall happen? He falls in love head over heels with Delilah. All right? And evidently they're playing the kind of games that I just, you can figure it out. And she says, okay, what's your strength? And he makes up some bull story about chains. And so she's, oh, let's try it out. He ties one of the chains. So, oh, here come the police. They go, boom, right? Ha, 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 how strong I am. Okay, let's try the second one. Let's take some tendons. Okay, we take the tendons. Ah, should police do it? Boom, throw the tendons off. And she says, oh, you're lying to me. Like, oh, okay, I'll tell you the real story. The real story is take my hair and put it in a 7 looms, right? And then I won't have any strength. Okay, time 7 looms. Here come the police team. Boom! Kills a bunch more police team. By the way, killing police team left and right. All right? So she goes, she gets really upset. Says, what's going on? How come you treat me like this? And finally he says to her, okay, the reality is if you cut my hair, I'll lose all my strength. Why doesn't he just turn around and say, give me a sip of wine, I'll lose all my strength? It's not all that clear from the story of Shimshon that he is in any way prevented from drinking wine. And then it seems like the one thing, because remember, in this case, the mother, the malach said to the mother, he should not have a haircut, you don't drink wine, which is some bizarre thing, and I have no idea what that's about, that she shouldn't drink wine, but it's not on him. So this whole thing is just bizarre. We still got to figure out what it's doing here and how this story functions. So let's just quickly see to the end, and then I'll share a couple of suggestions. Now that's weird. Manoach says to Hashem, please send that guy back so he can tell us what to do. Well, you don't trust your wife? Your wife is the one who told you, I saw this guy, this is what he told me. So Manoach says, okay, well, you know, I want to get it straight. All right, maybe Manoach feels bad that he didn't get to see a Malach or an Isha Elohim. Vayishma Elohim call Manoach. God listens to Manoach. Very nice. He also listened. Ishmael, Vayishma doesn't. Okay. Anyways. Vayivom Malach Elohim od el ha'isha. Yosher v'asadeh Manoach isha inima. But here's a patch and pony. All right. Manoach, please, I want to see the Malach. I said, okay, I'll let you see the Malach, but he's going to show up to your wife. Right? She'll slap you along. So she's out in the field and she's on her own. A quick little story. In the winter of 2001, January of 2001, the Intifada had just gotten started. I went with a friend, and we went to near Tzora, and we're standing on that spot. And he says, okay, if you are a field worker, where are you going to work? We're standing on a hill, and you look that way, and it's towards Ashdod. You look that way, it's towards Yerushalayim. Where are you going to work? I said, well, I guess that way, because I don't want to be facing the police team. Says, okay, very good. So we take a walk into that field, and I'll tell you later what we saw. It's in the parak. All right, so she goes and runs to tell her husband, the guy who showed up that day, he's back. So Manoach follows his wife. By the way, notice throughout this, Manoach and his wife are not together. It's not show us, tell it. You saw it, I want to see it. He follows after her. Says, you send the one you sent to her, send to me. Right? Are you the one to talk to her? Talk to me. Vayom Noach, I tell you about Varecha Maya Mishpatanar Maseo. So good. When this happens and the baby's born.
Marriage, right?
What?
It sounds like a typical marriage, right?
It sounds like not a great marriage. A typical Tanakh marriage, right? Yeah. All right. And they just seem to be on different universe, on different planets. And that won't remain. You'll see something nice happen here. And now it gets really, really strange. Because I can kind of, sort of, maybe understand why the mother who's carrying the baby who's going to be a Nazir has to avoid wine. It's very hard to understand why the father, whose job was already done several months ago perhaps, whose input was already recorded on this, now has to avoid all this stuff too. Very strange. Mikol asher yitzei migefen hayayin lo tochal v'yayin v'shechar al teisht. You can't drink wine. Now, there's two ways to read this. Lo tochal might mean third person feminine, right? But almost everybody reads it as second person masculine. You don't eat it. V'yam shechar al teisht, you don't drink it, because otherwise you'd be lo teisht. V'chol tuma al tochal, you can't eat anything tameh. Kol asher tzviti al tishmor. Everything I told her, you got to keep too. So you got these parents who are Keri Nation, but there's nothing to them about cutting their hair. Tumat Maid isn't mentioned here anywhere. And then she has been told that the kid can't cut his hair and nothing about drinking. So this is just, to call it a Nazir is very strange. It's almost like it's a borrowed term. So the Manoah says to the guy, we want to bring an offering to you. Not an offering, but like hospitality. We're going to make a goat for you. You want to bring something to me? Bring it to Hashem. Bring it as a korban. Okay? In other words, means Manoach didn't understand this guy's a malach. That's why Manoach's offering to feed him. Which, of course, a little bit, kind of, sort of, maybe takes us back to Avram and the three guests. Kind of, sort of, maybe. But not a whole lot. So, what's your name? We want to honor you. We'll call you to the bris. We'll maybe name our kid after you. Right? Mr. Quad Reigns. Says, why ask my name? My name is indecipherable. It's wondrous. Okay? A little red swirling music in the background. Okay. So he prepared the offering anyways. Where does he put it? On a rock. That's where that comes from in Rashi Yatzar. What happens? Suddenly it goes up, and Manoach and his wife are watching. By the way, notice they said man na'asela narhan ayulad. Suddenly it's, we're operating together. Okay. The fire goes up and the malach goes up in the fire. Pretty cool. But belav ha-mizbeach. Wait, wasn't it a tzur? Okay, so Jabo, a teacher of mine, takes me in this field. And we're walking around, walking, and we find a little rock. It's a little rock. Yeah, a little boulder, like this high. Right, about 2-3 feet high. And there's four little corner pieces kind of carved down on the rock. So very interesting. This is a rock, but once you look at it, you realize it doesn't look like a rock. With the four corner pieces, it looks like a mizbeach. So they said that one time in probably 47, Yosef Braslavi, it might have been earlier than that, Yosef Braslavi was in Tzorah, helping the plants and Palmach thing. And the meeting was a couple hours later. So in the meantime, he went out to walk in the field and see what he would see. And he sees this rock and he bumps into some 4,000-year-old Arab who's shepherding his goats or whatever. And he says, what do you call that? He says, oh, we call that Madbach Manoach, the altar of Manoach. It's right there. It's right exactly at the spot that you would expect it to be. It worked perfectly. Manoach v'ishto ro'im v'ayplop ne'am arza. So their reaction is, again, they see this, and they fall on their face. Notice that throughout this entire episode, seven times the word ro'ah shows up in the context of them seeing the malach. This is critical because, and I'm going to give them mafteach to understand this because we've already laid up, sorry, is the first thing that Shimshon does when he's doing is he sees a beautiful girl in Timna, which is the way that God sees the first opportunity to create a conflict with the Plishtim, and thus get Shimshon started on his war against the Plishtim. How does Shimshon's career end? He's blinded. But what happens while he's blinded? He's playing and dancing in front of all the people, haro'im b'schok Shimshon, that are watching. Ro'im, Shimshon dance. And what does Shimshon do with all those people? He kills them all by pulling the pillars down. Seeing becomes an operative motif in this story. But why is this story here? So one suggestion that I like to just raise is that this suggestion really is a prelude. It really offers signposts as to what's going to happen in Shimshon's career. And Shimshon's career, in a sense, is the biggest disappointment of anybody's career in Tanakh. Because the promise at the beginning is so powerful. He's going to be this powerful savior who's not only raised as a savior, but who is his mother, he becomes pregnant with him so he can become a savior. Goes back to his very, very embryonic roots, literally. And he ends up really only starting the first bit of conflict with the Plishtim, and then he dies. And the career of Shimshon is a very difficult career to parse, to understand. However, an interesting thing is, where did the story start? With whom? It starts with his mom, his mother. Shimshon's entire career revolves around women. It starts with him marrying a plishti girl. It then has him going to the Zonah in Aza, and then with Delilah, and that's where everything ends. So perhaps this story is a story about great hopes and how they come crashing down, which in a sense, Jason, may come back to what you suggested earlier, that the great hopes of settlement in the land by tribes, which is what Sefer Dvarim envisions, now in Sefer Shoftim are unraveling, and we're seeing that we got to go to Plan B. And Plan B, of course, is Tun Lanu Melech. And Plan B is prefaced with Bayamim Mahim Ein Melech B'Yisrael. And so Shimshon, in a sense, becomes the most important story in Shoftim because it shows how significant it is that this doesn't work. And that all of the great hopes pinned on Shimshon as a savior end up a little bit of a shadow of something happening. And yes, there's some skirmishes, and 1,000 plishtim die here, and 3,000 plishtim die there, and Po Vasham, a few other plishtim get killed, and 300 jackals get a chance to run around with torches between their tails, and that's cute. But the big stuff doesn't happen. And for the big stuff to happen, who is it going to be who's going to fight the big war against the plishtim? That's going to be Shaul. And Shaul's going to fight that big war against the plishtim right after they come and ask for a king. And then ultimately, who is it going to be who's going to finally get rid of the plishtim? That's David. So all this points to David. But I believe that this story, this preface, this prelude to the story of Shimshon carries within it so much of the promise of what could have been and a lot of mysteries, and Shimshon being this unique kind of character, and there's way more here that we haven't uncovered yet, but you know.
And how does that tie into the Parsha?
Because again, the issue of a Nazir, that's the closest we can get as a Nazir.
So to the great expectation of a woman that's married and she...
Could be. I mean, the traditional understanding is the Nazir-Nazir connection. You're saying they could also be Sota. You know what? I could take it further. It's because Parshat Naso is what carries the great potential of Am Yisrael marching together and dedicating together, and it's only Bahalotcha that it falls apart with Vayim Am Kimitonim. So it may be indeed connected to that on a deeper level. Okay.
You could say that Shimshon's strength is his feminine side with the long hair, and as soon as that gets cut off...
Well, it could be, although it's that kind of strength isn't typically seen as feminine.
Why is his strength tied into his being an Nazir?
Yeah, so that we'd have to go back to this pasuk of Ki Nazir Elohim Iyam Min HaBeten V'Hu Yachel Oshit Yisrael seems to be a cause and effect. Is that his ability to fight is going to be dependent on that Nazirut. But again, that Nazirut is a unique kind of Nazirut because, remember, there is Nazirut, which is physical. There is Nizirut, which is internal, and there is Nizirut, which is invisible. The Nizirut, which is physical, is hair. The Nizirut, which is internal, is what you imbibe. And the Nizirut, which is invisible, is Tumat Meit. And the only component of Nizirut that Shimshon at all seems to be affected by, or bound by, is the purely physical.
He never takes a vow at all.
Never, right, which is why Reb Shimon says...
How can he really be a Nizirut?
So that's why Reb Shimon's argument in the Mishnah... It says, Shimshon lo haya nazir, shelo yatzta nazirut mipiv. Good. Okay.